American Giant makes great clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
This is Dr. J. Buzz von Ornsteiner, forensic psychologist from Copycat Killers, Real Channel's true crime program about real murders inspired by movies. Be sure to subscribe to our series on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Then go to Reels.com, that's R-E-E-L-Z.com, to find true crime TV series like this one on Reels Channel.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised. Taxi Driver. A psychological thriller about one man's slip into insanity.
Taxi Driver was recognized as an important movie. Little did people know in 1976 how it would impact history.
Centering around an unstable Vietnam vet with a thirst to kill. Most viewers are left trembling in their seats.
This is a character with lots of blemishes, an alienated, lonely character.
When one audience member fails to separate fact from fiction, there is no telling how many people will be hurt.
Oh, boom, boom!
With people with severe mental illness, while most of them, of course, are not violent at all, the ones that become violent, there are very often things that are referred to as copycat violence or copycat murder.
This copycat crime rocks a country to its core.
He wants to leave a mark, you know, which is ironically what he ended up doing.
John Hinckley makes a decision. I'm going to kill the president.
The 1976 release of the film Taxi Driver sparks unprecedented amounts of controversy in the entertainment world.
Russell Williams, professor of film studies, American University.
When this movie came out, no one knew what to think. Its themes were so dark and rigid, essentially unheard of in Hollywood at the time.
Starring Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle and Jodie Foster as Iris, Taxi Driver highlights a delusional Vietnam vet's attempt to save a 13-year-old prostitute from the streets of New York.
Certainly, this is not something you would find in a Disney movie. It shocked a lot of people. It scared even more. But why? Because it felt so real.
Travis thinks the only way to rescue Iris from her sleazy life is by waging war on her solicitors. Off the screen, there is a 21-year-old Dallas native named John Hinckley Jr. who thinks he can do the same. Growing up in an affluent family, Hinckley can't seem to find his footing in life.
Del Quinton Wilbur, author, Rawhide Down.
John Hinckley was born into privilege. He was the son of an oil services executive who actually owned his own company.
Hinckley came from a family where success was expected. And he was not achieving success.
After dropping out of college, John decides to pursue a music career in Hollywood. His parents financially support his dream since their son has nothing else going for him.
He had this idea that he could be a music star. Not a great idea for someone who had very little training in music.
But like so many others who flock to Hollywood in pursuit of the American dream, John finds himself on the outside looking in.
He's trying to be a songwriter, but really, he never leaves his apartment. He thinks he has these grandiose dreams, but he spends all of his time eating fast food, living in Hollywood, this ramshackle apartment.
John begins to despise the city.
I think John Hinckley had a hard time understanding at first why he wasn't successful in Hollywood. He thought that he was an unappreciated talent.
Seemingly, John has no friends and no one to turn to while living in Hollywood. Until he sees the film Taxi Driver. John instantly relates to the film's main character, Travis Bickle.
Douglas Linder, law professor, University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Both the Travis Bickle character and John Hinckley were very lonely, alienated people. And he began to become increasingly fascinated with the lead character.
One screening turns into another until Hinckley eventually sees the movie 15 times. It's an alarming fact that Dr. William Carpenter, who conducted a psychological evaluation on Hinckley, can't look past.
He got confusion in his own identity with that of the taxi driver.
I think John Hinckley found himself in 1976 in a deep, deep hole. And he saw the movie as sort of a map for getting out of his hole.
John Hinckley can't get over how he and Travis are alike. Both men are loners who can't seem to find their way in life. As time progresses, John Hinckley decides that whatever he does in real life will emulate what Travis Bickle does in the movie.
Because Travis Bickle, the character he identifies so much with, becomes obsessed with Jodie Foster, it's only natural that John Hinckley himself would begin to develop that fascination with Jodie Foster.
Like Travis Bickle in the movie, Hinckley thinks he has to save Jodie Foster, and he even develops romantic feelings for her.
I think the solutions that John Hinckley saw in the movie were the same solutions that Travis Bickle saw. Violence can be the answer. Jodie Foster could be the answer.
He put more and more of his own identity into things that were picked up from that repeated viewing.
As Hinckley continues to sink deeper and deeper into isolation, he looks to Travis Bickle for help.
Hello? Hey, Mom. I'm good, good. How are you? I actually met this girl. Yeah, she's an actress, yeah. I think you would really like her.
In the movie Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle develops a love interest and just an unreciprocated relationship. John Hinckley, interestingly, takes that relationship and uses it to develop an imaginary relationship that he shares with his parents.
Hey, Mom. Yeah, well, I mean, we had a great time. We went down to Santa Barbara, and it was beautiful. I really wish you could meet her, but it's just so tough to schedule now.
He writes to his parents about trips that they've taken together. He talks to his parents on the phone about this character, who is non-existent. It's a character that was really only inspired by the movie Taxi Driver.
She's busy all the time, I heard.
His mother is happy that John has finally found a partner, not knowing it's all taken from the pages of a movie script.
She continually thought, well, at least he's got this one girl. He's got this person who can support him. And in fact, there was nobody there to support him.
Oh, are you talking to me?
This woman existed only in the mind of John Hinckley.
With every passing day, Hinckley's love affair with the movie only gets more and more dangerous.
By 1979, things are getting pretty alarming. He begins to develop a real fascination with guns.
Hi, can I help you?
Can I see that little symbol on right there?
Sure, that's your 32 caliber, 6-shot.
Can I see that other silver one with the wooden handle?
Sure. This one here, yep. This is your 45 caliber. Pretty much similar to the same thing. 6-shot.
It's a little heavier.
Yeah. That's more kick to it. This will take down your target a lot quicker.
But it's a lot louder, though, too, right?
Yeah. It does make more noise quicker.
I think I like this one.
Okay.
He buys one gun, then he buys more guns.
I'm sure that he felt some kind of empowerment from it.
You talking to me?
You talking to me?
While alone in his apartment, John Hinckley starts imitating scenes from Taxi Driver.
You talking to me?
In the movie Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle is shown in his very sterile one-room apartment. He's got a gun that he's playing with in various ways. John Hinckley is clearly obsessed with that particular scene in the movie.
For the first time in his life, John Hinckley feels like he is someone special. But in reality, he's a ticking time bomb.
Oh, boom! Oh!
Just like the suicidal Travis Bickle.
I think a clear sign of how far John Hinckley has slid downhill is in the late fall of 1979. Two times, he takes a gun, puts it next to his head, and plays Russian roulette. And that's something that only somebody that has a pretty clearly disturbed mind would do.
By 1980, John's obsession with Taxi Driver reaches the point of no return. After reading an issue of People magazine, he learns that Jodie Foster is enrolled at Yale University.
So Hinckley lies to his parents and says, hey, I'm in a writing class at Yale. I'm going to be a writer, and I'm going to go. So he gets their money, treks across the country, and goes to Yale. But he's not there to study. He's there to stalk Jodie Foster.
And when he arrives to Yale, things don't go according to plan.
What are you laughing at?
I think these constant brush-offs, given his obsession with Jodie Foster, begins to cause Hinckley to think about, how can I achieve this sort of unity with Jodie Foster? What can I do?
As his overtures to Jodie Foster were rebuffed, the same way Travis Bickle's overtures were rebuffed, he decides, okay, I'm going to make sure that Jodie Foster never forgets me.
Audiences fall in love with Jodie Foster after she stars in the film Taxi Driver. So much so that she receives an Oscar nomination. Unbeknownst to her, there is one fan who is taking the movie a little too seriously, John Hinckley Jr.
Jodie at this point was becoming Hollywood's next It Girl, so it's no mystery why people were obsessing over her. Hinckley, on the other hand, took his obsession to toxic levels.
Hinckley decides to up his stalking game and head to Yale, where Jodie Foster is currently enrolled as a student. But once there, John's afraid to approach his star crush.
John Hinckley's a very shy guy. It was almost beyond his imagination that he could go up to Jodie Foster and simply begin a conversation. So what he does is start with a couple of phone calls.
Jodie ignores all his attempts at communication.
He calls her and she's like, who is this?
It's John.
And gets his name wrong.
John Hinckley. John Hinckley. Haven't you got any of my messages?
And another time, he hears laughing in the background.
What are you laughing at?
He asks Jodie Foster, what are you laughing at? What are they laughing at? I don't get it. What are they laughing at? She says, they're laughing at you.
Desperate for her affection, John writes Jodie Foster a poem titled, I Know a Girl.
I know a girl who is beyond words. I don't know her well, but I know her. And she knows that I love her. I don't know her true feelings towards me. But she knows that I know her name.
To John's chagrin, his efforts still don't leave an impression on Jodie Foster. But it isn't going to deter Hinckley from getting what he wants.
Hinckley, like Travis Bickle, can't handle rejection. I mean, it's a feeling he despised. But because of this film, he knows just what he has to do to change that.
Hinckley errantly thinks that killing will be the only way to get Jodie's attention. And he's got a target on his mind that is sure to grab headlines. President Jimmy Carter.
Sure, because Travis Bickle focused his first thoughts about violence on a politician, John Hinckley would do the same. And what better politician to focus your violence on than the President of the United States?
It's an act of lunacy that most people can't begin to comprehend or justify. But John Hinckley Jr. isn't like most people.
He was arming himself. He was paying attention to ammunition. He was doing things much the way the caretaking that Travis Bickle did.
John Hinckley goes to Nashville. He ends up at a rally that Jimmy Carter is holding and begins to scope it out, much like the character Travis Bickle does in the movie.
John Hinckley gets dangerously close to the president.
Now we're getting into some dangerous territory. He gets within arm's reach of the president. Arm's reach of the president of the United States.
The madman seems poised to make history.
John Hinckley has a gun in Nashville at a rally that Jimmy Carter is participating in. He was within range of Jimmy Carter.
But will he commit the ultimate sin and kill the president?
At that point, he can't pull the trigger. He's not quite there yet. He hasn't fallen down the shaft quite far enough.
Even so, it's only a matter of time before he explodes.
John Hinckley might not have been ready to pull the trigger, but he's clearly thinking about it. He's getting himself ready.
Shortly thereafter, he is arrested at the Nashville airport.
Do you have any papers for this, sir?
I do. I don't have them with me.
You don't have them with you?
No, I don't have them on.
The charge is illegal possession of a firearm.
Hinckley is merely given a $62 fine and is released from custody. John's foray into madness only intensifies after his initial encounter with President Carter. Although John Hinckley is virtually let go with a slap on the wrist, his parents sense that there is something not right with their son after learning about the gun charge.
John Hinckley's mother could fully appreciate that her son was not normal. Something was clearly wrong. And it was time to put him into counseling.
I'm just a little bit worried about him, and he just seems a little down and usually engages more. And just want to know really why, if there's any reason.
Tell me what happened at the airport.
I just forgot it was there.
Do you usually carry around a gun?
No.
Do you have a fascination?
No, I do not. I do not.
So how are you feeling? Is anything troubling you?
The therapy John Hinckley receives proves to be ineffective because John Hinckley doesn't talk about his obsession with the film.
He was revealing none of this to the psychiatrist. He's basically seeing the psychiatrist because his parents insisted on it. So none of this was known to anyone else.
The psychiatrist diagnoses Hinckley as being emotionally immature.
Should definitely hold back on money.
So the suggestions that the Hinckley family is getting from the psychiatrist is essentially to make John Hinckley become a real person. Make him do his own thing. Don't provide quite as much support.
Should really stop supporting him?
By eliminating John's only connection to the outside world, there is no telling what he will do to get the attention of movie star Jodie Foster.
Clearly, he was looking for some way out of his desperate situation. He understood he needed to do something, and he increasingly turned his thoughts to dramatic things, like assassination.
Now on his own, John Hinckley buys two more guns, totaling seven in his arsenal. And his fixation with Jodie Foster reaches a boiling point. The lovelorn Hinckley can't go one more day without telling Jodie exactly how he feels. On March 10th, 1981, he writes her a disturbing letter.
Jody, goodbye. I love you 6 trillion times. Don't you maybe like me a little bit? You must admit it. I am different. It would make all the difference.
He gets very despondent. And he decides, you know what? I'm going to go across the country and it's time. I'm going to go kill Jodie Foster. Kill Jodie Foster and myself. Or, you know, just kill myself in front of Jodie Foster. He hadn't made up his mind yet.
Will John Hinckley Jr. do the unthinkable?
Faced with rejection, Travis Bickle turns to violence. Faced with constant rejection, John Hinckley turns to violence.
In the movie Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle's precarious mental state keeps audiences on the edge of their seat from beginning to end. And on March 10th, 1981, John Hinckley Jr. seems to be following his cinematic equal, shot for shot.
He loved this movie so much because his life is this movie. He was a loner and a psychopath. And like Travis Bickle, he was intent on killing to get what he wants.
Right now, the only thing John Hinckley desires is the affection of Jodie Foster.
He writes to Jodie out of desperation. Jodie, goodbye. I love you 6 trillion times. Don't you maybe like me a little bit? He's lovelorn. The letter is essentially a plea. He's begging her to notice him, but she never does.
There is no telling what lengths John will take to capture the only thing existing in his world. But soon, everyone will know just how maniacal John really is.
He is on his way to New Haven to kill Jodie Foster, kill her and then himself, or just kill himself in front of her on campus in an orgy of violence, right? Which is also kind of linked to Taxi Driver, right? I mean, that guy had murderous impulses.
As the bus makes its way across the country, it makes a layover stop in Washington, D.C.
John Hinckley checks into a hotel in downtown Washington and has a very restless night of sleep.
Now, with Ronald Reagan in office after defeating Jimmy Carter in the 1980 election, John Hinckley changes his plan of action.
In the morning, he wakes up, goes to McDonald's, has a little breakfast, and picks up the Washington Star. He's back in his hotel room looking at the Washington Star and sees that Ronald Reagan has an appearance scheduled that afternoon, conveniently close by at the Washington Hilton.
It sparks an idea straight from Taxi Driver.
The scary moment about this whole thing was that while Travis Bickle had fantasies of killing a presidential candidate, he got scared and didn't do it. John Hinckley was more than willing and ready to kill.
That very day, John puts pen to paper and creates a declaration of sorts.
Dear Jodie, there is a definite possibility that I will be killed in my attempt to get Reagan. It is for this reason I am writing you this letter now. This letter is being written only an hour before I leave for the Hilton Hotel. Jodie, I'm asking you, please, to look into your heart and at least give me a chance. With this historic deed, to gain your respect and love. I love you forever. John Hinckley.
It's a love letter, right? A love letter that he thinks is going to transit the grave. You know, that's something someone writes when they think they're going to be shot and killed an hour later when they do something to impress this person.
Hinckley's twisted letter to Jodie Foster is undeniable proof that his affinity for the actress has reached a fever pitch.
He was a dangerous person. He was desperate to achieve the fame and to establish the relationship with Jodie Foster.
It's not a matter of if John will carry out his plan. It's a matter of how many people will die along the way.
He takes out bullets, loads his gun, and heads towards the Washington Hilton.
It's Dr. J. Buzz von Ornsteiner. Did you know you can stream the Copycat Killers TV series on Roku and Fire TV? Well, you can. Just download the Reels app and subscribe to see the TV show behind this podcast. And if you've got Prime, it's on Amazon channels too. You could even find episodes about killers inspired by Breaking Bad, Hannibal, and The Dark Knight, before they're released here. Plus, you'll get to see what I look like in the show. I know you're curious. Copycat Killers comes from the real crime fans at Reels Channel. Find Reels on your TV at Reels.com. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com.
Around 2:30 p.m. in the middle of broad daylight, John Hinckley Jr. waits patiently outside the Washington Hilton Hotel, where President Reagan is speaking to a labor convention.
So you've got guns, you've got John Hinckley, you've got desperation, you've got the president giving a speech. It's all there. We're going to have trouble.
As Hinckley waits in the crowd, everyone is oblivious to what is about to go down.
This was a moment that John Hinckley was waiting for. He anticipated that this historical deed, as he called it, would somehow bring Jodie Foster and him together.
In the movie Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle's attempt to kill a presidential candidate is thwarted by security agents who sense something is awry. But John Hinckley Jr. is prepared to go off script to succeed in his mission. A black limo is parked a few feet away from where John is standing. It is the vehicle in which Reagan will exit the area. When the hotel door opens, President Ronald Reagan emerges from the inside with a group of Secret Service agents and staff members surrounding him.
Reagan emerges from the hotel. He waves to the crowd. John Hinckley thinks that he's waving just to him.
As he's being ushered to his waiting vehicle, Reagan has no idea that he's being targeted.
He knew what he had to do. He was there. He had the gun. He had his finger on his trigger. And all he had to do was pull.
As Reagan is set to enter the limo, a voice peaks from the throng of people. It's John Hinckley Jr.'s.
John Hinckley shouts out,
"Mr. President! Mr. President!"
John Hinckley Jr. is about to spring a trap on the leader of the free world in 1981, President Ronald Reagan. His perverse fascination with Jodie Foster originates from his warped psychological bond to the film Taxi Driver.
Oh, boom!
Outside of the hotel, Hinckley waits for Reagan to get closer. He places his finger on the trigger of a hidden pistol.
At that moment, the connection was in his mind. I killed the president. This is going to be a historical deed. And Jodie Foster will realize the depth of love that I have for her.
Mr. President. Mr. President.
He fires six shots. They hit people. One of them misses everybody. One hits the car.
Outside of the limo, armed guards quickly identify their shooter.
Secret Service agents, as you might imagine, spot the problem and immediately go after Hinckley, jump on top of him.
Hinckley is quickly detained, but his attack leaves four people seriously injured outside of the hotel.
The most seriously injured was Press Secretary James Brady. It's a miracle, really, that no one did die. James Brady came precariously close to dying with a bullet lodged in his brain.
The other victims, police officer Thomas Delahanty and Secret Service agent Timothy McCarthy, both receive non-life-threatening wounds. And there is another person who was hit with a bullet.
Let's go back! Let's go back!
But the sixth bullet bounces off the limousine and hits Ronald Reagan and lodges itself just an inch from his heart.
Surprisingly, Reagan doesn't even realize that he's been shot.
Immediately, the thought is drive him back to the White House, drive him back to safety. And then he begins coughing up blood.
Are you okay, Mr. President?
No, you're not. Let's go to the hospital. To the hospital now.
The limousine has to take a turn and head to the hospital. Ronald Reagan's life is in danger.
At the hospital, Ronald Reagan is able to walk himself into the emergency room. But soon later, he collapses on the floor and is rushed to the operating room.
He gets to the operating room, and they're searching frantically for this bullet. They're operating on him, and a surgeon is hunting frantically for this bullet in Reagan's chest, worried it's going to slip into an artery and shoot into Reagan's brain and kill him.
Luckily for the president and the entire nation, Reagan survives the operation.
Reagan had one of the most scripted presidencies up to this time of anyone in history. Most scripted campaigns. He was an actor. That script got jettisoned at 2:27 p.m. when John Hinckley opened fire with those six shots. There was no more script.
While in police custody, FBI agents questioned John Hinckley Jr. about the attempted assassination. But Hinckley only wants to talk about one thing.
I have a question for you.
Go ahead, you can ask a question.
Were the Oscars postponed this year?
What the heck? Are the Oscars still on?
Yes.
As it turns out, the Oscars are scheduled, and John Hinckley asked an investigator whether they've been postponed.
Were the Oscars postponed this year?
Yes, the Oscars have been postponed. Why do you ask? Yeah.
They're being postponed to John Hinckley is a sign that his deed was really historical. It was making news, and the message would be getting to Jodie Foster.
As FBI agents continue their interrogation, John Hinckley starts opening up about his potential motive.
Is it just you? Did someone tell you to do it?
Ron's wallet. I don't know what the significance of these are. Talk about it.
They've gone through the contents of his wallet, and they found a bunch of pictures of a woman.
The girls in the wallet, John. Who are they?
Why are they there?
Is it your girlfriend?
I think if you have this, you know the story.
Hinckley tells the agents about the hotel room he has been staying in, and even reveals that there is a letter there that explains it all. When the FBI arrives to the hotel and finds it, they can hardly believe what they are reading.
For investigators, the letter is a real curveball. When you see somebody try to assassinate the President of the United States, your first thoughts turn to politics. It turns out that's really not Hinckley's gripe at all. He's not a terribly political person. He didn't care whether he shot President Reagan or he shot President Carter.
The agent realized, holy cow, this isn't about the president. This isn't even about Ronald Reagan. It's not about the world. It's about a man's obsession with a movie star.
Some other items found in John's hotel room are two boxes of bullets, a VHS copy of Taxi Driver, and a postcard.
One odd item found in Hinckley's possessions was a postcard. On the back was a message to Jodie Foster. You are a virgin, aren't you?
When Jodie Foster hears about Hinckley's disturbing motivation behind the assassination attempt, she finds herself beyond belief.
For Jodie Foster, this disrupted a life that she was hoping would be as normal as possible for a student at Yale. She's another victim. I mean, in that sense, Jodie Foster is another victim of John Hinckley.
And it won't be the last time Jodie Foster hears from John Hinckley Jr. In the wake of his trial, John Hinckley might get a chance to stalk Jody again.
America was shocked. You know, people wanted someone to be held accountable.
Very few people can comprehend how the film Taxi Driver propelled John Hinckley to commit one of the most crazed assassination attempts in the history of the United States.
The news was a shock to the country. Here's the president of the United States, a new president of the United States. He'd only been in office 2 months. And already the assassins were after him. It seemed to be a very scary prospect for a lot of people.
But the craziness of the case is only just starting. At his trial, John Hinckley's defense pleads not guilty by reason of insanity.
John Hinckley shot the president, and the government had it on videotape. There was no possible defense based on the normal defense. I didn't do it, right? The only possible defense here was an insanity defense.
One of Hinckley's defense experts, Dr. William Carpenter, states that John identified in many ways with Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver.
He was forming false beliefs. With people with severe mental illness, while most of them, of course, are not violent at all, the ones that become violent, there are very often things that are referred to as copycat violence or copycat murders. In that sense, some process like that may have been going on with John Hinckley when he was taking on this identity with Travis Bickle.
According to Carpenter, Hinckley absorbed the identity of Travis Bickle and thought he was rescuing Jodie Foster as Bickle so famously does in the film.
My conclusion was that he suffered from schizophrenia. The condition itself affects different people in very, very different ways. They'll process emotional information differently. Hinckley did not have a normal emotional reaction to or responsivity to ordinary things.
In 1982, the burden of proof falls on the prosecution.
Back then, you know, the insanity defense actually was reversed. And so if you raise the insanity defense as a defense, as a defendant, the government's burden was to prove you were sane at the time, not the other way around.
After a two-month-long trial, the jury reaches their verdict.
In the end, after 3 days of deliberation, it was a hard verdict to reach, the jury comes back with a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity. By and large, the public was shocked to hear this verdict.
Although Hinckley is found not guilty, he is hardly a free man.
When you're found not guilty by reason of insanity, that doesn't mean you're free to walk out the door. He was institutionalized at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, a hospital for the criminally insane and others, in Washington, D.C.
Hinckley is to remain at St. Elizabeth's for an indeterminate amount of time.
He had to stay there until he could convince the judge ultimately that he was no longer a danger to himself, no longer a danger to Jodie Foster, no longer a danger to presidents, no longer a danger to anyone.
During his first year at St. Elizabeth's, John Hinckley shows little growth. He attempts suicide by overdosing on antidepressants, but fails.
Clearly he is not without mental problems for many years after his admission to St. Elizabeth's.
John Hinckley's therapist works endlessly to try to break his obsession with Jodie Foster.
Hello?
Hello.
I thought I'd come and we could have a chance to talk a little and find out how you're doing.
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm a little concerned about you. You're seeming very lonely.
Yes, but I can write, so that helps.
You write? Oh. Can you tell me about your writing?
I usually just write letters and don't mail them or write my thoughts.
When you write letters, who are you writing letters to?
I think you know.
I know? Are you sure? Why don't you tell me who you share your letters with?
I sometimes write to Jodie.
So you're still sending letters to Jodie? Do you think she likes to get these letters?
I hope so.
What do you have to say to Jodie?
I just tell her how I feel and what I'm thinking and what's going on. Because I know she has feelings for me, and I think she likes to see that I still have feelings for her.
He was obviously getting a lot of psychotherapy and therapy at St. Elizabeth's through this period. But he still is like, he was writing letters to Foster still, right? He's still obsessed with her.
The most important thing in my life is Jodie Foster's love and admiration. If I can't have them, neither can anyone else.
However, over time, doctors see some improvement with Hinckley.
You can believe two things, right? You can believe he's been rehabilitated, right? Mentally rehabilitated, or he's faking it. And I don't know the answer.
How are you feeling today?
Okay.
We'll take you off the medication, and hopefully you can finally have some outside visits soon. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Okay.
Be nice.
Yeah, definitely. Hopefully some of your family members can come and visit and cheer you up a little bit.
In 1992, Hinckley is taken off his psychiatric medications and allowed to leave hospital grounds unsupervised.
As John Hinckley's rehabilitation continues, as his condition improves, he's given increasing privileges. He's allowed to spend more time outside of St. Elizabeth. He's allowed to have contact with more people. But there are continuing restrictions. It might be that John Hinckley is never a totally free person. He will also always be monitored in some way.
It is a controversial decision questioned by many.
I think people came to realize, you know, he was crazy or could have been crazy or some matter of the three, I think. But it was not a very satisfying verdict.
However, Hinckley's punishment is actually a blessing in disguise.
The charge against John Hinckley was attempted murder, which carried a maximum sentence of 20 years. More than 20 years have passed, so if John Hinckley had been convicted of the crime, he'd be free to go out and do whatever he wanted to do right now. Today, he still is under supervision. He still is in St. Elizabeth's.
But one thing is certain. Because of Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver, Jodie Foster will never be out of John Hinckley Jr.'s mind.
He got his wish. I believe his wish was to really get on Jody's radar in a way that couldn't be denied. And maybe he did want to be famous. Maybe he wanted his name, you know, indelibly etched in history. Well, he was successful in that tragic venture.
If you enjoyed this episode of Copycat Killers, don't forget to subscribe at Podcast One or Apple Podcasts. Then go to Reels.com. That's Reelz.com for clips, extras, and more from the TV version of the series, including chilling reenactments and crime scene photos you'll only find on Reels channel. Find Reels on your TV at Reels.com. I'm Dr. J. Buzz von Ornsteiner.